Public Broadcasting Network listeners. Today is the first day of October in the year of our Lord Jesus Christ, 2023. This is yours truly, Myrrh. We have a chat room, yourstrulymyrrh.chatango.com. And it's a summer day here. It's 87 and going for a record. It's very beautiful and the colorful trees. And be sure to go to republicbroadcasting.org or call them or send donations to them, please, if you can. And visit the sponsors, especially DixieRepublic.com. You can email them at ProudSouthern123@gmail.com and tell them RBN sent you. So we have a guest today, and I think we're going to get strafed first. This is what happened in the Balkans, okay? When Wes Clark, actually Khan, K-A-N-N-E, and Ashkenazi, was the Supreme Allied Commander over there, and they didn't lose any men because they killed everyone from the air. So I think I hear those planes coming now. Okay, thank you, Sam. I think like Michael Gaddy said, when are we going to call war on war? How about we just call it all off? Yeah. We have a guest today, Darrell Wayne. I like to say his name, brings out my Southern accent. DW, he's a retired commercial airline pilot and many hours and miles under his belt. And he's also been an instructor and self-employed in Darrell, can you come on and introduce yourself a little bit more? And then if you would like to, after that, get started with the story we want to hear about. Thank you.
Well, yeah, well, hi, Mer. Hi, everybody. Good Sunday to everybody. It's beautiful here, too. We're only 80 degrees here in the South today, Mer. You're hotter up there in Wisconsin than we are here.
I know.
So... yeah, and what's this? Do I understand this correct? Is this going to be? Is this your premier first 2 hour long?
Yes, thank you.
Show today.
Thank you for mentioning that. And we agreed to take calls in the last half hour of the second hour, right?
Yeah.
Okay, we'll work on that. Everybody knows the phone number.
Yeah, my pleasure to hang out with you on Sunday afternoon.
I appreciate it.
And, we were talking a couple weeks ago about you want, you know, that was, well, what's that been now? Almost 3 weeks ago now with the anniversary of 9/11 and all the thoughts and feelings and conversations that go along with that particular day every year. And you know, it's important. Extremely important, and something that we should never forget and continue to chip away at.
The reason I asked you on is because I had heard your story before, and I wanted the Republic Broadcasting Network listeners to get to hear the full story. So thank you.
I don't know. I don't like have it written down, you know. It's when I start to talk about it, I just have to sort of, you know, experience it again, you know, sort of walk through it.
And, well, that's what makes it really special. Like, yeah, that's what makes it really special. That's what I really like, and we'll have plenty of time.
Sure. Well, heck, let's just get going on it then. I was flying for a smaller luxury sort of operation out of Milwaukee. It was called Midwest Airlines. Small operation. We flew DC-9s, old DC-9s, with luxury interiors for the passengers. We had first-class service for everybody. It had 2x2 seating in it, so with leather seats, and a lot of people called it the chocolate chip cookie airline because they always baked hot chocolate chips on the airline for most every flight. And when they served you, you got china and linen. And so it was quite the operation. We also had some McDonnell Douglas aircraft called MD-80s, MD-82s, and MD-88s. And so that was the fleet. I think at the highest time there were probably just over 300 pilots at its largest point, and of course that varied a little bit. So back in September of 2001, I was a relatively new captain on the DC-9. I at that airline since 97. And I was in 2001. I was a captain, and in the morning of 9/11, I was sitting in my home at the table having breakfast with my buddy from Chicago, who was a pilot. And on that particular morning, I was scheduled to take the second flight from Milwaukee to New York City, LaGuardia, and my buddy was going to from Milwaukee to Washington, D.C. And so we both had, you know, trips to the East Coast that morning. And his wife lived in Chicago, and she called the home phone there, and she says, "Are you guys watching TV?" And I seldom ever watch TV, and we said no. And she said, "Well, turn the TV on." And so we turned the TV on. And you know, about a minute later, after turning the TV on, the second airplane slams into the World Trade Center on live TV. Right. So we both sort of look at each other, and we're both in our wonderful Captain Polyester uniforms. And we just sort of look at each other and then just go sit down. And we both knew that neither one of us were going to go flying that day, you know, as soon as we saw that. And I don't know, I suppose we spent probably a half an hour or so watching the rest of the, you know, news reporting on the TV. And we both got phone calls from our dispatch and you know, saying the flights were canceled, everything was grounded. And so at that point, you know, I just shut the TV off, and I walked over to where I had the stereo, and I pulled out my favorite Rachmaninoff CD and started to play that. And I think later that day I went to Home Depot and bought a miter saw and started building a fence in my yard. I know that sounds a little odd, but there wasn't anything else to do. And so that would have been on a Tuesday morning, and on Thursday afternoon, I received a phone call from my dispatch, and I lived about 5 miles from the airport, right on Lake Michigan there. And so dispatch called me. She said, "Look, you've been tapped to reposition a DC-9 tonight from Milwaukee to Columbus, Ohio. And we have a special waiver from the FAA to do this. And on Friday morning, you're going to leave Columbus, Ohio, very early, and you're going to fly into New York, LaGuardia, and pick up 80 passengers. And I said, okay. You know, so when dispatch calls you, they sort of, you know, in control of your schedule and your life, and if you do, you're best to show up when they tell you to show up. So when I got to the airport, we call it the ready room. It's under the concourses, the passenger concourses, and that's where dispatch, maintenance control is, and that's where the crews all come together underneath the concourses to, get ready to do their flights. And so we got there about, a little over an hour early. I met my FO, the first officer they had assigned to the flight, and he'd only been in the job online about a month. He was brand new. He couldn't have had more than 5 hours in that plane actually on the line. And he wasn't even a U.S. national. He was he was Finnish, and he was working on I don't know what they call it, a visa or whatever. And his name was Tron, T-R-O-N. I'll never forget that. That's quite a name. And very nice young man, very competent. I had three flight attendants. And they were kind of very sort of nervous. The flight attendants were very nervous. And so I went into dispatch, got the weather briefing, got the paperwork for the airplane. Looked everything over with my first officer, signed the paperwork. Went back out with the flight attendants and talked about what we were going to do. And here's the really interesting thing that struck me particularly funny or odd was that, as far as we knew, this was the first jet airliner commercial aircraft that had been released into the U.S. airspace after the 9/11 event. 2 days later, we had, at that time, we had like three chief pilots for the different, airplanes and crews, all making good money. None of them showed up. We didn't have any supervisors there for dispatch. They just had the regular one dispatcher. The flight attendants had their own executive and administrative group that oversaw their actions. None of those people showed up from the supervisor or administrative staff. Then we had a bunch of executive sort of people, the kind that walk around with the ties and the, the shiny shoes on, and none of them showed up. Okay, so here we are, these five people that are going to operate this aircraft in this airspace now after these events, and nobody from the FAA had provided any information. Nobody from the company or the supervisory or executive had thought it worth, participating.
And, well, it sounds like we're going to have a little break here, Daryl, so we'll be back in a few.
Okay.
Hang on.
Hello, hello, hello from beautiful Colorado. My name is Samuel Jung Kay, and I am currently the lead Shilajit hunter and master herbalist for Colorado Shilajit Company. In this video series, I will be discussing what we believe is the greatest of all adaptogenic superfoods and the single greatest natural healing remedy gifted to us by Mother Earth. I think you too will become as excited by this incredible substance called Shilajit as we were and are after our discovery of this amazing gift right here in beautiful, colorful Colorado. You may already know Shilajit by other names: Shilajit, Momio, Momi, Mami, Mineral Pitch, Asphaltum, and others. Shilajit literally translates to destroyer of weakness and conqueror of mountains. Shilajit has been in use for thousands of years and is considered as the highest valued cure-all of any earthly substance.
Look for the gold mountain and medical symbol logo in banners on republicbroadcasting.org to watch the full video and see more information. Use code GORBN when ordering. That's G-O-R-B-N.
Consider this. Dead people see only what they want to see. And frankly, most of us are still dead. Let me give you the lessons of gold and five easy lessons. Number one, don't buy it because you need to make money. You buy gold because you need to protect the money you already have. Don't ever look at the price as a barrier. Look at it as an incentive. Number three, don't buy its paper pretenders. We talked about that a lot. Buy gold. Buy the real thing in the form of coins and bullion. Fourth, don't fall prey to glitzy television or Facebook ads. Do your due diligence instead. And that's what I try to provide you with and have for 26 and a half years on the air and 30 years in this profession. Fifth, don't allow naysayers to divert your interest. Allow yourself the right to protect your interests as you see fit. Jeff Bennett here. One of the ways you can do that is to contact Kettle Moraine Limited. Contact me by calling or texting me at 602-799-8214. 602-799-8214. You can also email me at kettlemoraineltd@cox.net. Let me help you protect your wealth and your family today. Once again, call or text us at 602-799-8214 or visit our website, Sierra.
Okay, I guess we're back here. Unless I'm jumping the gun, which wouldn't be unusual. So, Daryl, how'd you like that Rachmaninoff? Sam's on it.
Well, I got to give it to Sam. He was all over that. That was great, Sam. I'll tell you the reason why I pulled that CD out on 9/11 was because it seemed like appropriate for the situation, and that it was more the events of that day were more like a requiem for the fall of this this nation, you know, and because we all knew, at least in the aviation business, we all knew that it was a new world. Everything changed right there, and so.
If that had really been an attack from foreigners, you know, had legitimately been an attack rather than an exercise going live, the command would have been launch the world. They would have given it everything they had. So, obvious by its absence, right?
Yeah, It was theater at its highest level, but anyway, I'll continue with where I think I left off there. And thanks, Sam. The So we were all looking at each other and at the ready room, and flight attendants were very nervous, you could tell. And we had no support or dialogue from FAA company or anybody else. And in Milwaukee, they actually, across from the field of the airport, across the road was a FISDO center, a Flight Standards District office, you know. So, you know, I just had to take it on the word of my dispatcher that they had a special exemption and flight release for us. And so anyway, we were talking about how we would deal with this, and they said, well, you know, the flight attendants asked a perfectly good question. They said, well, what do we do if there's a problem? And this is before we had secure doors on the cockpit. You could literally have kicked any of them open with your foot, and you know, they're just like folding doors, you know, like lightweight material. And I said, well, you know, if here's what we're going to do. We're just going to do all of our training exactly the way we've always done it. I said, when we're flying the passengers on the live leg from LaGuardia back to Milwaukee, we're going to leave everybody down. Everybody's going to stay down. They're going to stay seated. They're going to stay with their seat belts on. And I said, if anybody has to use, facilities in the back of the airplane, that'll be addressed only one person up in the aisle at a time. And that's with permission and recognition from the flight attendant. And I said, you know, how much you guys to coordinate that? I said, if there is any altercation back there, or if there is a problem, I said, give me three knocks on the door. Call me on the interphone if you can. If you can't, you know, three knocks on the door. By whatever means you need to let me know that there's a problem in the back. Of course, I know this sounds over the top now, but, you know, in that moment, we had to have some plan of action, an action plan with the front and the back part of the airplane. And so I told him, and I laughed, you know, a little bit, tried to put him at ease a little bit, the flight attendant. So I said, look, if there really are problems back there, I said, what I want you to do is, I said, I want you to go to your seats. I said, I want you to lock yourself in. And I said, I'm going to bounce these people off the top of the airplane. And I said, don't let anybody tell you that a DC-9 can't do rolls. I can assure you it can. I would have bounced them off the ceiling if there had been somebody trying to take over that cockpit. And they sort of laughed about that. And you could see it, that relaxed them a little bit. But at least we had talked about it. We had a plan, see. And so we departed Milwaukee early evening, flew to Columbus, no problem. It was very strange, though, because of the events. But, you know, we're used to operating in a fairly crowded airspace with, you know, general aviation and private aircraft and corporate jets and a lot of other jet airliners. And you're going past Chicago and these places. And there was nobody. It was absolutely silent. We were the only ones in the air. Air traffic control didn't have anybody to talk to except us. So, you know, we got pretty good handling, you know. And it reminded me, there might be people in the audience that remember this book by Stephen King. Stephen King wrote this book called The Langoliers, and there's a couple of airport scenes in there in that book called The Langoliers, where there wasn't any, it was, the world was empty. You know, that's sort of how we felt. So
okay, are we getting another break? Yeah, bottom of the hour break. So we'll be back in 3 or so minutes. Thank you, Daryl.
Yeah, you bet.
Tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
Homeowners, if your lender has gone out of business or sold your transaction to another lender or servicer, you may be the victim of a wrongful foreclosure resulting in the loss of your home. If you've already lost your home, are in foreclosure, or even in good standing, you can challenge the mortgage transaction's illegal issue and your property can be restored to you, and your foreclosure can be stopped or reversed and the mortgage transaction declared unenforceable. State laws, U.S. title codes, the Uniform Commercial Codes, and U.S. Supreme Court rulings have upheld that defective mortgage documentations can reverse or stop foreclosures and enforce property title claims in favor of the homeowner. We are having successes in stopping the process of foreclosure, the enforcement of the foreclosure judgments, the sale of property, and evictions after the sale. We are not attorneys, and we don't give legal advice. We are a professional team of legal researchers, providing forensic mortgage audits and expert witnesses. We have the knowledge to produce the evidence and enforce laws regarding your legal issues. We've been in business for 12 years without a complaint. Consultations are free, and we provide a free title search to confirm if your mortgage has legal defects. Please call 855-253-3748. 855-2-KEEP-IT today.
Hi, Tom Bolton for Ease Off. I know so many of you are finding our Easy 4 carcass drop and lift an essential tool for your meat processing operation. But today I want to spotlight four of our new products. First, our right height hog cradles with steel or aluminum frames. Our customers love this back-saving innovation that enhances sanitation and speeds production. Next, our beef cradles with stainless steel or aluminum frames eliminate rust and corrosion. We hope you'll compare our quality and prices for this essential part of your processing line. Our cradles are especially effective when used with our power skinner. And finally, our hook tumbler will keep your hooks clean and polished. EaseOff.com. We make pigs fly. Cows, too.
EaseOff, LLC, 417-932.
Can you pick up where you left off? Thank you.
Oh, sure. I was just thinking there that this might be the first time in RBN history that Rachmaninoff was used for bumper music. I love it.
I don't know. Sam's a pretty prolific keyboard artist himself, and he's a fan of Rachmaninoff, so they may have beat us to it.
Oh, okay.
it sure fits. Yeah.
It sure does. Yeah, thank you. We departed Milwaukee, went to Cleveland, spent the night there, completely uneventful. Next morning we get up early. We had a clearance waiting for us at Columbus, Ohio airport. This is normal. Everything was normal, other than the fact that the entire airport is completely empty. There's no aircraft moving. It's very, it's just a very strange sort of disorienting, you know, you might even say surreal might be a great way to describe the just the general feeling of the crew. But, you know, once you fire the engines up and you get moving, you know, the muscle memory and all your training kicks in and you just, you know, you just start to do your thing. And so we left. We left Columbus, Ohio, in the DC-9, and they brought us into the clearance brought us into New York from a southerly route, and we came directly in a line right over the top, basically, of the Statue of Liberty. As we came over the water, approaching Long Island. You pretty much just fly straight down the East River. And at this time, we were like, oh, I don't know. I think it was like 2,000 foot above the ground. Being on your altimeter anyway. And I was flying that leg. And but I always carry with me a digital camera, and we were slowed up. You know, there's an arrival into New York LaGuardia, and from that direction, it's called the Maspeth Tanks One Arrival. It was then, that's what it was called, and there's these huge oil tanks up by LaGuardia Airport and Shea Stadium that you do a visual arrival. You fly a circuitous route around them, and I, you know, I'd done it many, many times, and so the Long Island was going to be on the left side of the aircraft as we flew, and I transferred controls. We were hand flying it. We weren't really using the autopilot. I transferred the flight controls and the power levers over to my first officer Tron. I said, "I want you to fly here until I request to take the aircraft back." And so he, you know, did that perfectly fine. And I had my digital camera pulled out. And as we flew by Long Island, we came directly over the top of the World Trade Center complex in a bird's eye position. I mean, you could see directly down into it, and the whole complex from that position and that altitude, and you could see fairly clearly. And I probably took 5 or 6 photos, and we were slowed up. We were probably, you know, roughly saying we were probably doing about 200 miles an hour, which is fairly slow for us. And so I had plenty of time to focus and take some snapshots. And what I and the photos revealed it later too. But you know, what I found interesting is that I saw glowing red spots on the ground in that complex area. And, you know, I didn't spend a lot of time thinking about that in any sort of deep detail at the moment, but that's what I observed. And so, you know, we flew past that up the East River. I took back control of the aircraft, and we did the visual arrival into Newark LaGuardia. And we landed on runway 31, which is, you know, no big deal. And once we got on the ground at LaGuardia, the airport is, once again, it's empty. And that is so unlike New York LaGuardia Airport. It is just nothing but hustle, hustle. You got aircraft going every which direction on the taxiways to the terminal, from the terminal, and it's a small airport. There's not a lot of room, and the controllers talk fast, and you really have to be on your A game there. And on that day, it was, you know, dead silent. You know, we landed, and just as I taxied off the runway onto the taxiway, you know, tower controller said, well, just stay with me. You're clear to the gate. Now, that never happens at New York LaGuardia. Anyway, so we taxi up to our gate and, you know, park the aircraft. And the gate agent comes down, hands me the paperwork, and, you know, she said they're going to start boarding the aircraft in about 15 minutes. And so we start turning it around, getting it ready to go, and you know, doing a post-flight and a on the aircraft. The first officer walks around the aircraft, checks everything, makes sure it's good. You know, I'm picking up the clearance and loading the navigation equipment, and we're getting ready for all that. And so we had 80 passengers, and I have to tell you that almost to a person, every one of them that got on that airplane wanted to stop and look inside the cockpit as to who is up there. And we heard a lot of comments. And they were very, very fidgety, very nervous. Some of them were kind of emotional, the passengers that were. And once we got everybody in and seated, and we got ready to push back, I got on the PA, made a PA announcement, explained to the passengers under the circumstances that this flight would be conducted with, you know, special consideration of remaining in your seat at all times. If any, you know, as I said earlier, if you needed to use the facilities, that, you know, that'd be fine, but that would be done on a, you know, individual basis with the cooperation with the flight attendant. And so, no big deal. We flew back to Milwaukee, completely uneventful. That was the end of that. So, you know, at that point, you know, I don't know when they opened Airways back up. Was it three or four more days? They started conducting, other airlines started conducting scheduled operations when they opened
Airways. I forget how long it was. Yeah, but yeah. I understand the, what's her name's, the Bin Ladens were flown out first.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, you got to get rid of the evidence, you know, but, you know, I went through, I'll bet it was, you know, 5 years after that before I really started to dig into paying attention and being very outspoken about the events, and particularly the aspects of the failures of security from an airline pilot's point of view and an instructor. And you know, I admit it. I mean, I was probably with, like most people at the time, it was I sort of bought the story a little bit, not entirely, but more than I should have. And of course, I was very busy, and that the company and the FAA was re-indoctrinating and retraining, you know, crews in new procedures, and the Federal Flight Deck Officer Program, where the crews were trained to be armed. I went through that training as well, so we were carrying H&K 40 calibers, semi-automatic pistols on board, which you had to go through Federal Air Marshal training to do that, which I was a part of that. And so that's Department of Homeland Security. Wow. I guess that made me a Fed. Who would have thought? So, anyway, I sort of figured, like most people, they would you know, actually provide, you know, real proof and evidence, and there would be, you know, a real story to go along with the events, and it never happened. And the longer it went on and the weirder it got, the more I dug into it, which, you know, led me to the point where I am now, that I understand, you know, what's going on to the extent we can. So, did you have any questions, Mer?
I'm trying to think now. I was wondering, you said you had a plane full from Milwaukee to LaGuardia, and then one from LaGuardia back to... Oh, no, I missed... Okay, how was that?
I might have... If I misstated that, let me clear that up. We flew empty from Milwaukee to Columbus, Ohio, and then the next morning we flew from Columbus to LaGuardia, and then the only leg we had passengers was from New York LaGuardia back to Milwaukee on a Friday morning.
And it was so, these 80 people that didn't seem special, right? You said...
They didn't seem special to me. I mean, there was a mix of, you know, ages and, you know, males and females. And I didn't notice anything any particular, you know, I didn't notice them as VIPs or anything. So
makes you wonder, why send a plane specifically to, you know, for them? Everyone else was grounded, you know. Yeah,
right.
Just me.
Yeah, exactly.
Makes you wonder.
It's a great question. It's a great question. I've thought about it several times. I have no answers for that. And you know, I'm just sitting at the pointy end driving this thing. And but it was probably about so that was 2001, probably about 2004, 2005, maybe even six, but we were flying. We had started getting rid of the DC-9s, and we were flying Boeing 717s, which were we called it the electric jet, where it had flat screen panels and computer operated everything, and I was captain on that, and so one of our flights, 2005 or six. We had a trip into Reagan National and with an overnight, and so we flew in there for the overnight, and my first officer who flew with me that evening, he lived in Washington, D.C., so I didn't know that at the time, but, you know, I said, well, you know, I'll see you down at the hotel for dinner. He says, no, I live here. And I said, oh, okay. So I'll see you in the morning. And his name was Al. And he, you know, was a pretty quiet guy. He usually kept to himself pretty much. And so, you know, uneventful evening. And the next morning we get out there, you know, 6 o'clock or 5:30 in the morning, something like that. And we all show up, get the aircraft ready, get it fueled, you know, the same old routine. And we got it done pretty early. And we had a pretty full plane going back to Milwaukee. And so Al and I are sitting there reading the paper, drinking coffee, which is two of the favorite things for pilots to do, drink coffee and read the newspaper. And I was just sitting there, you know, and it just sort of hit me. I go, well, here we are. We're in Washington, D.C. Al lives here. And I looked over at him and I go, hey, Al, I got a question for you. I go, what were you doing on the morning of 9/11? And he kind of stopped and looked at me and he goes, well, you know, I was here at the airport. I go, really? I go, I hear you were inside the airport. He goes, no, I was out. I was coming to work, and he says, I was outside in the employee parking lot getting out of my car when I heard and then saw, you know, the smoke and stuff, the explosion at the Pentagon. Now, the Reagan National Airport and the Pentagon are very close to each other. And in order for, you know, I don't expect many people to realize this because you kind of have to know the geography. But if you know the location of the employee parking lot for Reagan National and the site of the Pentagon that's hit, in order for the supposed, ostensibly, the wide-body Boeing jet aircraft, if you're going to use that, to have struck that side of the Pentagon, on it would have had to flown directly over the employee parking lot. And so that was me understanding that. I said to him, I go, so, I mean, wow, Al, what was that like to be standing outside of your car and have a wide-body Boeing come over the top of you at, you know, they said 500 miles an hour, which is impossible. But I said, what
impossible.
Was that like?
Might have sounded kind of like that opening strafers we played here, huh?
Right.
If it had happened.
Exactly.
But that was synthesizer, too, so.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, it seems like a reasonable question to me. What does that look and sound like, you know, to have that 250,000-pound aircraft come over the top of you or more? And he said, well, it didn't happen. And I sort of got that dumb look on my face, you know. And I go, well, what do you mean it didn't happen? He goes, Daryl, look, he says, the first time I knew something was wrong was when I heard the sound of an explosion. And then when I looked in that direction, I saw smoke rising. I go, really? He goes, yep. And so that kind of left me a little dumbfounded, because here I have a guy that I trust. He has no reason to fib or, you know, make any stories up or anything. I've been asking him questions. He hadn't been trying to tell me something. There's a difference, you know. I'm looking for information. I started the whole conversation. And he's just, you know, telling me what, you know, happened in, you know, his experience. And so it was about the time we had to start closing the aircraft up and getting ready to leave. And so I said, well, let's talk about this later. So we did all that, you know, took off, climbed out, got out over flyover land. And we talked some more about it. And he just had to keep repeating to me that there was no aircraft that had flown over the top of him. And I think that's when I really got serious about paying even more attention to unworking the lies. And aerodynamically, these things couldn't occur in the way, in the fashion that the people describe them. The aircraft could not have been maneuvered to hit the Pentagon in the way they said it, at the angle that it was hit. The aerodynamics of the aircraft in the situation they're talking about, it would literally have disassembled itself in mid-flight and in the air due to structural failure associated with something called flutter in the control surfaces. And then to impact the Pentagon at the angle that it shows as far as the evidence on the side of the building, that aircraft with that incredibly wide wingspan would have had to flown into what we call ground effect, and at which time at that speed, that hypothetical speed that they claim, and then it to fly into what's called ground effect, which is the distance between the bottom of the aircraft and the span of the wing. So if it was like, you know, if that was like 170 feet, as soon as you got within 170 foot of the aircraft in the ground, you would have started to encounter ground effect, and the closer you got, the more of that effect you would have got. And you can think of it, if you want to, as like a cushion of air. And at those speeds, what would have happened, you know, in layman's terms, to get you to help visualize it? It would have been like skipping a flat rock across the water. It would have, as it entered into ground effect at that speed, it would have just ballooned. It would have ballooned itself up over the top of the building. So the only way that an aircraft like that, operating at those speeds, could have actually impacted that building would have been in a steep dive. Probably something like a 45-degree dive, which whatever hit the side of that building doesn't show that those physical effects. So, you know, those are just basic aerodynamics and physics, and then eyewitness evidence. You know, I don't know. Does the government actually have to come out and say, okay, we're bad, we did it before, and then people still wouldn't believe it. You know,
yeah, if you're waiting for that, that's never going to happen, right?
Right. You know.
Well, same thing with abusive parents, right?
Right.
They're not going to be held to accountability. I mean, you can forgive them, you know, but good chance that, you know, they won't be admitting to anything.
No. Not sure.
Oh, we've reached the top of the hour here, so we've got a few minutes and then we'll be back again. I'll hear some more of this. Thank you, Daryl.
Future medicine will be the medicine of frequencies. What did he know? Imagine you hear ocean waves caressing a beach, or a favorite song from the past, or the trickle of the babbling brook. All of these are sound frequencies that positively affect us. Terahertz is a soothing, healing frequency that has been proven to resonate at the same frequency as healthy cells. It penetrates the body and stimulates new healthy cell growth. Want to diminish muscle aches, joint pains, and experience a greater sense of well-being? Tired of spending money on short-term remedies that never seem to work? Soothing, healing, relaxing terahertz frequency is now available and as handy as flipping a switch. Terahertz technology is changing the course of what we were taught about how to maintain our health and well-being. To learn more about this amazing breakthrough, go to naturalearthmedicine.com. That's naturalearthmedicine.com.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.